clerks volunteered to watch and help in any way possible, and his return to the store was greeted with marked demonstrations. All this has been brought about by the element of personal love introduced into the business. This love is not mere words, but the business itself is carried on under a system of cooperation that is not a patronizing recognition of inferiors, but a real sharing in the whole business. Other men on the street look upon Milton Wright as odd. It is a fact, however, that while he has lost heavily in some directions, he has increased his business and is today respected and honored as one of the best and most successful merchants in Raymond. And there is Miss Winslow. She has chosen to give her great talent to the poor of the city. Her plans include a musical institute where choruses and classes in vocal music shall be a feature. She is enthusiastic over her life work. In connection with her friend Miss Page, she has planned a course in music, which, if carried out, will certainly do much to lift up the lives of the people down there. I am not too old, dear Caxton, to be interested in the romantic side of much that has also been tragic here in Raymond, and I must tell you that it is well understood here that Miss Winslow expects to be married this spring to a brother of Miss Page, who was once a society leader and clubman, and who was converted in a tent where his wife, that is to be, took an active part in the service. I don't know all the details of this little romance, but I imagine there is a story wrapped up in it, and it would make interesting reading if we only knew it all. These are only a few illustrations of results in individual lives owing to obedience to the pledge. I meant to have spoken of President Marsh of Lincoln College. He is a graduate of my alma mater, and I knew him slightly when I was in the senior year. He has taken an active part in the recent municipal campaign, and his influence in the city is regarded as a very large factor in the coming election. He impressed me, as did all the other disciples in this movement, as having fought out some hard questions, and as having taken up some real burdens that have caused, and still do cause, that suffering of which Henry Maxwell speaks. A suffering that does not eliminate, but does appear to intensify, a positive and practical joy. Chapter 20. But I am prolonging this letter possibly to your weariness. I am unable to avoid the feeling of fascination which my entire stay here has increased. I want to tell you something of the meeting in the First Church today. As I said, I heard Maxwell preach. At his earnest request, I had preached for him the Sunday before, and this was the first time I had heard him since the association meeting 4 years ago. His sermon this morning was as different from his sermon then as if it had been thought out and preached by someone living on another planet. I was profoundly touched. I believe I actually shed tears once. Others in the congregation were moved like myself. His text was, "What is that to thee? Follow thou me." It was a most unusually impressive appeal to the Christians of Raymond to obey Jesus' teachings and follow in his steps, regardless of what others might do. I cannot give you even the plan of the sermon. It would take too long. At the close of the service, there was the usual after-meeting that has become a regular feature of the First Church. Into this meeting have come all those who made the pledge to do as Jesus would do, and the time is spent in mutual fellowship, confession, question as to what Jesus would do in special cases, and prayer that the one great guide of every disciple's conduct may be the Holy Spirit. Maxwell asked me to come into this meeting. Nothing in all my ministerial life, Caxton, has so moved me as that meeting. I never felt the Spirit's presence so powerfully. It was a meeting of reminiscences and of the most loving fellowship. I was irresistibly driven in thought back to the first years of Christianity. There was something about all this that was apostolic in its importance and Christ's invitation. I asked questions. One that seemed to arouse more interest than any other was in regard to the extent of the Christian disciples' sacrifice of personal property. Maxwell tells me that so far no one has interpreted the Spirit of Jesus in such a way as to abandon his earthly possessions, give away of his wealth, or in any literal way imitate the Christians of the order, for example, of St. Francis of Assisi. It was a unanimous consent, however, that if any disciple should feel that Jesus, in his own particular case, would do that, there could be only one answer to the question. Maxwell admitted that he was still, to a certain degree, uncertain as to Jesus' probable action when it came to the details of household living, the possession of wealth, the holding of certain luxuries. It is, however, very evident that many of these disciples have repeatedly carried their obedience to Jesus to the extreme limit, regardless of financial loss. There is no lack of courage or consistency at this point. It is also true that some of the businessmen who took the pledge have lost great sums of money in this imitation of Jesus, and many have, like Alexander Powers, lost valuable positions owing to the impossibility of doing what they had been accustomed to do, and at the same time what they felt Jesus would do in the same place. In connection with these cases, it is pleasant to record the fact that many who have suffered in this way have been at once helped financially by those who still have means. In this respect, I think it is true that these disciples have all things in common. Certainly such scenes as I witnessed at the first church at that after service this morning, I never saw in my church or in any other. I never dreamed that such Christian fellowship could exist in this age of the world. I was almost incredulous as to the witness of my own senses. I still seem to be asking myself if this is the close of the 19th century in America. But now, dear friend, I come to the real cause of this letter, the real heart of the whole question, as the First Church of Raymond has forced it upon me. Before the meeting closed today, steps were taken to secure the cooperation of all other Christian disciples in this country. I think Maxwell took this step after long deliberation. He said as much to me one day when we were discussing the effect of this movement upon the church in general. "Why," he said, "suppose that the church membership generally in this country made this pledge and lived up to it. What a revolution it would cause in Christendom. But why not? Is it any more than the disciple ought to do? Has he followed Jesus, unless he is willing to do this? Is the test of discipleship any less today than it was in Jesus' time? I do not know all that preceded or followed his thought of what ought to be done outside of Raymond, but the idea crystallized today in a plan to secure the fellowship of all the Christians in America. The churches, through their pastors, will be asked to form disciple gatherings like the one in the First Church. Volunteers will be called for in the great body of church members in the United States, who will promise to do what Jesus will do." Maxwell spoke particularly of the result of such general action on the saloon question. He is terribly in earnest over this. He told me that there was no question in his mind that the saloon would be beaten in Raymond at the election now near at hand. If so, they could go on with some courage to do the redemptive work begun by the evangelist and now taken up by the disciples in his own church. If the saloon triumphs again, there will be a terrible and, as he thinks, unnecessary waste of Christian sacrifice. But however we differ on that point, he convinced his church that the time had come for a fellowship with other Christians. Surely if the First Church could work such changes in society and its surroundings, the church in general, if combining such a fellowship, not of creed but of conduct, ought to stir the entire nation to a higher life and a new conception of Christian following. This is a grand idea, Caxton, but right here is where I find myself hesitating. I do not deny that the Christian disciple ought to follow Christ's steps as closely as these here in Raymond have tried to do. But I cannot avoid asking what the result would be if I asked my church in Chicago to do it. I am writing this after feeling the solemn, profound touch of the Spirit's presence, and I confess to you, old friend, that I cannot call up in my church a dozen prominent business or professional men who would make this trial at the risk of all they hold dear. Can you do any better in your church? What are we to say? That the churches would not respond to the call, "Come and suffer"? Is our standard of Christian discipleship a wrong one? Or are we possibly deceiving ourselves? And would we be agreeably disappointed if we once asked our people to take such a pledge faithfully? The actual results of the pledge as obeyed here in Raymond are enough to make any pastor tremble, and at the same time long with yearning that they might occur in his own parish. Certainly never have I seen a church so signally blessed by the Spirit as this one. But am I myself ready to take this pledge? I ask the question honestly, and I dread to face an honest answer. I know well enough that I should have to change very much in my life if I undertook to follow his steps so closely. I have called myself a Christian for many years. For the past 10 years, I have enjoyed a life that has had comparatively little suffering in it. I am, honestly I say it, living at a long distance from municipal problems and the life of the poor, the degraded, and the abandoned. What would the obedience to this pledge demand of me? I hesitate to answer. My church is wealthy, full of well-to-do, satisfied people. The standard of their discipleship is, I am aware, not of a nature to respond to the call of suffering or personal loss. I say, I am aware. I may be mistaken. I may have erred in not stirring their deeper life. Caxton, my friend, I have spoken my inmost thought to you. Shall I go back to my people next Sunday and stand up before them in my large city church and say, let us follow Jesus closer, let us walk in his steps, where it will cost us something more than it is costing us now. Let us pledge not to do anything without first asking, what would Jesus do? If I should go before them with that message, it would be a strange and startling one to them. But why? Are we not ready to follow him all the way? What is it to be a follower of Jesus? What does it mean to imitate him? What does it mean to walk in his steps? The Reverend Calvin Bruce, D.D., of the Nazareth Avenue Church, Chicago, let his pen fall on the table. He had come to the parting of the ways, and his question, he felt sure, was the question of many and many a man in the ministry and in the church. He went to his window and opened it. He was oppressed with the weight of his convictions, and he felt almost suffocated with the air in the room. He wanted to see the stars and feel the breath of the world. The night was very still. The clock in the first church was just striking midnight. As it finished, a clear, strong voice down in the direction of the rectangle came floating up to him as if borne on radiant pinions. It was a voice of one of Gray's old converts, a night watchman at the packing houses, who sometimes solaced his lonesome hours by a verse or two of some familiar hymn. Must Jesus bear the cross alone, and all the world go free? No, there's a cross for everyone, and there's a cross for me. The Reverend Calvin Bruce turned away from the window, and after a little hesitation he kneeled. What would Jesus do? That was the burden of his prayer. Never had he yielded himself so completely to the Spirit's searching revealing of Jesus. He was on his knees a long time. He retired and slept fitfully with many awakenings. He rose before it was clear dawn and threw open his window again. As the light in the east grew stronger, he repeated to himself, what would Jesus do? Shall I follow his steps? The sun rose and flooded the city with its power. When shall the dawn of a new discipleship usher in the conquering triumph of a closer walk with Jesus? When shall Christendom tread more closely the path he made? It is the way the Master trod. Shall not the servant tread it still? Chapter 21. Master, I will follow thee whithersoever thou goest. The Saturday afternoon matinee at the auditorium in Chicago was just over, and the usual crowd was struggling to get to its carriage before anyone else. The auditorium attendant was shouting out the numbers of different carriages, and the carriage doors were slamming as the horses were driven rapidly up to the curb, held there impatiently by the drivers who had shivered long in the raw east wind, and then let go to plunge for a few minutes into the river of vehicles that tossed under the elevated railway and finally went whirling up the avenue. Now then, 624, shouted the auditorium attendant. 624, he repeated, and there dashed up to the curb a splendid span of black horses attached to a carriage having the monogram CRS in gilt letters on the panel of the door. Two girls stepped out of the crowd towards the carriage. The older one had entered and taken her seat, and the attendant was still holding the door open for the younger, who stood hesitating on the curb. Come, Felicia, what are you waiting for? I shall freeze to death, called the voice from the carriage. The girl outside of the carriage hastily unpinned a bunch of English violets from her dress and handed them to a small boy who was standing shivering on the edge of the sidewalk, almost under the horse's feet. He took them, with a look of astonishment, and a thank ye lady, and instantly buried a very grimy face in the bunch of perfume. The girl stepped into the carriage, the door shut with the incisive bang peculiar to well-made carriages of this sort, and in a few moments the coachman was speeding the horses rapidly up one of the boulevards. "You are always doing some queer thing or other, Felicia," said the older girl, as the carriage whirled on past the great residences already brilliantly lighted. "Am I? What have I done that is queer now, Rose?" asked the other, looking up suddenly and turning her head towards her sister. "Oh, giving those violets to that boy. He looked as if he needed a good hot supper more than a bunch of violets. It's a wonder you didn't invite him home with us. I shouldn't have been surprised if you had. You're always doing such queer things." "Would it be queer to invite a boy like that to come to the house and get a hot supper?" Felicia asked the question softly, and almost as if she were alone. "Queer isn't just the word, of course," replied Rose indifferently. "It would be what Madame Blanc calls outré." "Decidedly. Therefore, you will please not invite him or others like him to hot suppers because I suggested it." "Oh, dear, I'm awfully tired." She yawned, and Felicia silently looked out of the window and the door. The concert was stupid, and the violinist was simply a bore. "I don't see how you could sit so still through it all," Rose exclaimed a little impatiently. "I like the music," answered Felicia quietly. "You like anything. I never saw a girl with so little critical taste." Felicia colored slightly but would not answer. Rose yawned again and then hummed a fragment of a popular song. Then she exclaimed abruptly, "I'm sick of most everything. I hope the Shadows of London will be exciting tonight." "The Shadows of Chicago," murmured Felicia. "The Shadows of Chicago." The Shadows of London, the play, the great drama, with its wonderful scenery, the sensation of New York for 2 months. "You know we have a box with the Delanos tonight." Felicia turned her face toward her sister. Her great brown eyes were very expressive and not altogether free from a sparkle of luminous heat. "And yet we never weep over the real thing on the actual stage of life. What are the Shadows of London on the stage to the Shadows of London or Chicago as they really exist? Why don't we get excited over the facts as they are?" "But the actual people are dirty and disagreeable, and it's too much bother, I suppose," replied Rose carelessly. "Felicia, you can never reform the world. What's the use? We're not to blame for the poverty and misery. There have always been rich and poor, and there always will be. We ought to be thankful we're rich." "Suppose Christ had gone on that principle," replied Felicia with unusual persistence. "Do you remember Dr. Bruce's sermon on that verse a few Sundays ago? For ye know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for our sakes he became poor, that ye through his poverty might become rich." "I remember it well enough," said Rose with some petulance. "And didn't Dr. Bruce go on to say that there is no blame attached to people who have wealth if they are kind and give to the needs of the poor? And I am sure that he himself is pretty comfortably settled. He never gives up his luxuries just because some people go hungry. What good would it do if he did? I tell you, Felicia, there will always be poor and rich in spite of all we can do. Ever since Rachel Winslow has written about those queer doings in Raymond, you have upset the whole family. People can't live at that concert pitch all the time. You see if Rachel doesn't give it up soon. It's a great pity she doesn't come to Chicago and sing in the auditorium concerts. She has received an offer. I'm going to write and urge her to come. I'm just dying to hear her sing." Felicia looked out of the window and was silent. The carriage rolled on past two blocks of magnificent private residences and turned into a wide driveway.